Well, good morning. Happy Thursday. Welcome to another edition of Perspectives on WFSU-FM. I'm Tom Blanigan. Hope you got through Hurricane Hermine in fine fettle, and normalcy is starting to return to your world, and we invite you to join ours for the next hour right here on Perspectives. Your comments and thoughts and experiences are always a vital part of the program at 414-1234, our local number. It's 800-926-8809 if long distance twixt you and us. Email perspectives at WFSU.org, and our Twitter account is at WFSUPerspectives. Well, this is Suicide Prevention Awareness Month, as designated by NAMI, the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill. So let's get this perspectives underway with a few statistics to boost that awareness, if we could. Each year, nearly 43,000 Americans die by suicide. Now, that is a number equivalent to the entire population of Thomas County, Georgia. And that makes suicide the 10th leading cause of death in the United States. And for every successful, if we can use that word, suicide, there are 25 attempted suicides. And as we heard, if you were listening to the debate last night, or sort of kind of debate featuring the two presidential candidates, 22 military veterans commit suicide every day in the U.S. So we're going to talk about that today. And again, we invite any comments or thoughts that you may have. And if you have had any experiences with suicide, someone that you know, a loved one in your household or a friend or whatever, we would love to hear from you and add your experiences to those of our panel here today. So first, let's meet him as we go around the table here. And we'll start with Dr. John Bailey, an osteopathic physician who's practiced psychiatry in Tallahassee, Florida, for 24 years. He's been recognized by the American Psychiatric Association as a distinguished fellow since 2003, board certified in psychiatry by the American Board of Psychiatry and Neurology. Also has served as president of the Florida Psychiatric Society and is now associated with a relatively new organization in this area called TMS Healthcare. Dr. Bailey, good to see you, sir.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
And I can't wait to find out some more about your practice and that group, since that is a new arrival on our healthcare environment here in town.
Happy to talk with you about it, sure.
We also say hi to Dr. Heather Flynn, clinical psychologist at the FSU College of Medicine. FSU, one of the National Depression Center sites.
Thank you, Tom. It's great to be here.
Yeah. How long has the school been associated with that designation?
About going on 2 years now. The NNDC, the National Network of Depression Centers, is relatively new, since 2010, and we're the most recent addition.
Congratulations. Great designation. Another feather in the cap of the FSU College of Medicine. And we welcome back to these microphones Mary Bowers, former NAMI Tallahassee Board President, has worked in public health and healthcare for nearly 30 years conducting mental health research studies. And if you recall an earlier visit from Mary, her daughter suffered with major depression for years and died by suicide in 2012. And gosh, Mary, that again is an experience I think that most folks can't even comprehend. So let's talk about your experience on that. What happened there with that situation with your daughter?
Well, you know, her boyfriend died by suicide when they were both 16. So she suffered with that with that guilt that she didn't save him for the next 15 years. She had many successes. It took her 7 years to finish college. She got her degree up at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. But then, you know, another friend of hers died by suicide while Brooke was in the hospital. So she felt like she let that person down. So I think, you know, she had many, many attempts, and I think the pain just got to be too much for her. She couldn't hold a job, even though she was very bright. In 2012 then, after suffering then with eating disorders and her PTSD and the major depression and her psychotic symptoms, it just got to be a little too much for her, I think. So, yeah, so she ended her life then.
It was such a cascade effect, though, with all those things just combining and conspiring to put her into that spiral.
Yeah, she had a tough time. She kept fighting back. But then, after a while, I think it just got to be too much.
Dr. Bailey, how often does that happen? Because for many people, it seems as though suicide comes out of the blue. Oh, my gosh. Who would have thought? He seems so happy. You hear that a lot. But in the case of what Mary was through with her daughter, this was on the horizon. I mean, you could almost see it, just almost an inevitability there.
Well, the impact of a suicide, that really gets to what the impact is of a suicide. And frequently, a frustrating thing that you hear in the clinical setting is, well, this isn't going to affect anybody but me. But that's not really so. The numbers bear out that the survivors of suicide, the people who knew the person who committed suicide, are at increased risk for committing suicide as well. And so there are hints that come along sometimes, especially if you really are getting in therapy to talking about things that most people don't talk about casually, that can give you an idea that somebody is really considering suicide along the way. As you say, in Brooke's cases, there were hints, but that did not make it any more stoppable, just because there are hints, and that can be a very frustrating part of it too, because ultimately it's difficult to control what another person is going to do. But there are things along the way that we can look at, and those include things like a change in frequency or severity of suicidal ideation, whether or not a person has a plan. Whether or not they're rehearsing that plan, that tends to be a particularly dangerous behavior. When we see that's very concerning. And then there are other risk factors, such as having friends and family, or such as engaging in behavior such as cutting or burning, which even though they're not intended to be suicidal, are associated with an increased risk of suicide as well.
One of the conventional wisdom aphorisms is, if someone even says in passing, in jest, I could just kill myself. That is the warning signal. You got to take that serious, right?
Not necessarily. From my perspective anyway, because people say that all the time. Me, as a survivor, it's like a dagger in my heart when I hear them say that, you know, but really, we just have to pay more attention to the language that we use, I think. You know, I don't think it's necessarily. Maybe, Dr. Bailey, you should say something about that.
Well, I often tell the students that I teach that if I did the very most extreme thing to do, which would be to involuntarily hospitalize someone, and if I did that with everyone who made a comment like that, mm-hmm. I would be spending all of my time unnecessarily hospitalizing
sure,
people.
Yeah. But it's something that so many people say, again, in jest and not realizing that this is serious, very serious business here.
Right.
Yeah. Well, what about the run-up to depression? Because that's the other thing. Anyone who commits suicide is mentally ill. There's something wrong. They're in the throes of deep depression, and maybe clinical intervention or some kind of medical help can turn that around. Heather, what do you think?
Yeah, you're right. Depression and other mental health conditions are extremely common among people who attempt and complete suicide. In fact, most people who have attempts or actually complete suicide have had encounters with the mental health system or with the healthcare system, for example, the emergency department or even a primary care setting recently within a time frame before they actually make that attempt. And so when you think about things like people making comments or having thoughts or things like that about suicide, you really need to think about the risk factors, as you're saying. And one of the biggest risk factors is having a mental health condition. Now, of course, that doesn't mean that all people with depression or anxiety or other mental health disorders will attempt or commit suicide. But it's a really strong risk factor. And so as we move into discussion about prevention and intervention, that's really arguably the main group of people that need lots of active outreach and efforts in terms of not only treating the mental health condition, but actively preventing suicidal behavior. And that's a component that we don't think about as much in the healthcare system.
Okay. And Mary Bowers, in the case of Brooke, it was not that she did not have intervention, that there was lots of help available. And you did everything you could reasonably to turn this around. And yet, ultimately, that it didn't work.
Right. You know, but I'm thinking of Dr. Bailey here. You know, Brooke was on antidepressants. She was always took her meds. She did, you know, she exercised. Then it got to be in excess, of course, which was not good. And she tried ECT for a while, had maybe a dozen or so treatments on ECT. But that depression was just so resistant. And as I was telling Dr. Stockwell, I wish TMS would have been around. Maybe, you know, maybe that would help Brooke. That was one thing that I'm sure she would have tried if it would have been there for her.
And that's on the other side of the break, what we want to get into, what TMS is a new concept, at least for Tallahassee, when it comes to dealing with depression and those sorts of situations. And we'll get Dr. Bailey to get into that on the other side of this timeout that's rapidly coming up. This is Suicide Prevention Awareness Month, as designated by NAMI, and that's why we're talking about it here on Perspectives, and would love to hear from you, too, at 414-1234, the local number. It's 800-926-8809, long distance, and perspectives at WFSU.org. Or the email. We'll be right back. Back on Perspectives, it's National Suicide Prevention Awareness Month, and we have an expert panel talking about it here on Perspectives with Mary Bowers and Dr. Heather Flynn and Dr. John Bailey with TMS Healthcare, and also your calls and emails as well. We were, before the break, talking, Dr. Bailey, about TMS Healthcare and your approach to dealing with clinical depression and those related kinds of things. What do you folks do, and how is that different from maybe other medical facilities or psychiatric protocols that we have out there?
Well, we're a new tool in the toolbox, and TMS is an abbreviation for transcranial magnetic stimulation. It's a new therapy that we have that's helpful when individuals have tried antidepressants and they're not working, or if they've decided that the antidepressants have not been tolerable because of side effects, for example. So the transcranial magnetic stimulation we've been doing for the last couple of years in Tallahassee, it's been available in Florida for longer than that, but it requires that the person who's undergoing it come in each day for 6 weeks in order to receive the magnetic pulses that are helpful in depression. This is a treatment that's been FDA approved since 2008. and has been used many thousands of times throughout the country. There are many TMS machines throughout the country now, and individual psychiatrists and facilities that are offering TMS, as well as major university facilities. Essentially, what it involves is using a very strong electromagnet, which has the intensity of an MRI magnet that's used for making images. But instead of making images, we're using this to depolarize neurons, specifically the neurons in the left frontal lobe that are associated with the structures that do not work well in depression. And the repetitive stimulation of that area brings those neurons back into functioning and also helps them connect with neurons that are part of what's called the limbic system, which is the emotional system of the brain. And it requires a repetitive stimulus during treatment sessions. A person sits in a chair that's similar to a dental chair, and the magnet is on an arm that looks like what a dentist might use when cleaning teeth or something like that, only instead of the dental apparatus, it has a magnet on top of it. And we apply that to the scalp and begin to pulse over the area. And we have an interesting procedure for doing that, because in order to know that we're actually depolarizing neurons and that we're actually in the correct area, we actually use the brain's motor strip. And part of the procedure involves pulsing over the area that and locating the area that moves the thumb. And so by using a magnetic field, we actually cause a person's thumb to move, even though they're not really thinking about moving their thumb, which is kind of a first in being able to even do that from a scientific point of view, and gives a lot of confidence in the fact that we are actually depolarizing neurons and that this is something that that we haven't been able to do before, even scientifically.
And what does the literature say? What's the efficacy of this type of treatment?
There are two different ways that that's measured. One is we look for a 50% reduction in symptoms, which is the typical way that when medication trials are done, that medications are judged efficaciously or not. When we're talking about – we call the 50% reduction a response. And then we also look at remission, and we call remission when we've got a reduction of about 90% of symptoms, depending on the scale that we're using. And we have some good numbers there. The report is good on this. It's we get between, depending on what populations are measured and what studies looked at, we're getting a 50% to 70% efficacy and or response rather, and then for remission we're getting between 30% and 40%, and of course that means that the other half of that percentage isn't responding. But if you compare this to next antidepressant, if you're about to start your fourth antidepressant and you've given the previous three a good trial and your diagnosis is recurrent major depression, a major study from several years ago called the STAR-D study tells us that your chance of responding to that fourth antidepressant is about 7% to 9%.
Oh, wow. So you've got diminishing returns as you go through the...
You've got a diminishing chance of having a response. And so when we have an opportunity to move those numbers into the 30% to 40% range for remission, and just for response, which is the usual measure, to move into the 50% to 70% range, we're really doing something that's categorically different. And so TMS is showing up on a lot of the practice guidelines for treating depression. The DSM-5 has just recognized that depression can come with mixed symptoms, and the TMS is also in the mixed symptom guideline for the treatment of depression. And so the treatment is becoming a recognized part of what else we can offer in terms of being able to help with depression, and something that can help sometimes when other methods have not been successful.
Yeah, well, the brain is an electrochemical animal, if you will, and if the chemicals don't work, maybe the electrical part of it will.
Well, that brings up a comparison. When people hear the word electrical, a lot of times they think about electroconvulsive therapy. One of the things that distinguishes TMS from electroconvulsive therapy is that unlike electroconvulsive therapy, we're not actually passing an electrical current through the brain. We're using a magnetic field to induce a natural electrical current in the brain, causing depolarization in a very specific area of the brain, whereas the objective of ECT is to cause a spreading cortical seizure under anesthesia. And there is no anesthesia required for TMS. It's very much like I told you the chair looks like a dental chair. It's very much like going to the dentist's office and sitting for 45 minutes and then leaving the office. So it's an easy treatment to tolerate in that regard. The indications for TMS are a little different than ECT. ECT works very well in certain emergency situations that TMS would not work as well in, because we've got a six-week treatment span that the treatment has to be delivered over. ECT is a lot quicker than that. But there are other conditions for which a number of individuals would not want to expose themselves to ECT, and TMS is nice option. There are very few contraindications to it. One important one is if there is a metallic object that's been surgically implanted in the brain or the eye, then we couldn't use a strong magnet if that is the kind of object that would respond to that magnet, because it could move and cause a catastrophe in that case. But people with pacemakers will usually want to consult the cardiologist and be sure that they're comfortable with using a strong magnetic field. Usually, if metals are more than about 30 centimeters away from the site that we're applying it to, though, we're safe.
Yeah, same kind of stuff that they do with MRIs generally, too. Same kind of cautions
very,
out there.
Very similar. We're a little bit more cautious with TMS when it comes to metal because we're using a repetitive signal, whereas MRI, there's not as much repetition in a single location. So, but it is very similar to some of the precautions you hear with imaging.
Thank you very much, Dr. Harvey is checking in with us on line one here on Perspectives. Hi, Harvey. Welcome.
Thank you, and thank you for taking my call. In the past, I'm a local pastor, and in the past, I have had people, persons, to come to me with making statements of killing themselves, and I have had three persons to actually go through with it and actually kill themselves, and it's like... you don't know when to take them serious, or is it that you take them serious at all times?
Well, that's a really good question. Let's go around the panel and find out, because so often people who are contemplating this will not consult clinicians or psychotherapists or those. They will go to their pastor. And I know there are many churches that offer pastoral training for this kind of situation. Not all churches, but many of them do. But should pastors maybe get additional instruction, or what do you think, Heather?
I think absolutely. You're completely right. There's a large segment of the population that would feel much more comfortable speaking with other members of their church or their pastor about some of the things they're struggling with. And it's a major important point of contact for people who are struggling with anything, mental health and thoughts of suicide. So I would really be in favor of pastors getting additional training in terms of asking more questions if they hear that from somebody, and how to ask those questions, and then what to suggest to the person, and how to continue to pay attention to that person in a way that minimizes their risk. And there's a lot of nice local resources in town. And so I really appreciate Harvey and his role, because it is so important.
Well, what is the role of the church or spiritual guides, do you think, when it comes to that, Mary?
I totally agree with Heather. that really is something that survivors of suicide look for, you know, of course, depending on their faith. For us, it was key to helping us through it, myself more so than my husband, for instance. People just deal with it differently, but I would love to see that too.
Yeah, because usually we're armed with platitudes in a lot of these cases, which has to be absolutely maddening for the survivors, because you hear the same, and I don't want to get into it right now, but we all know what they are, and that doesn't help, really.
No, uh-uh. But like, you know, Harvey said, I think if all of us are willing to say, to listen to the people who do talk about wanting to die and kill themselves. I think just listening and being a good friend like Harvey is very helpful.
Yeah, and Dr. Bailey, how do the survivors avoid the guilt? I know that's not your prime bailiwick, but you got to have some thoughts on that too. We all want to take responsibility because I guess we feel a little bit more perhaps omnipotent than we should in situations like this where if only I'd done that, if I'd only said this other thing, this would not have happened.
This comes up a lot in counseling survivors, and there has to be a distinction reasonably between what one can control and what one can't control. Frequently, I go back to an Alcoholics Anonymous thing called the Serenity Prayer, and basically it's saying, give me the serenity to accept the things that I – or rather, give me I always get this goofed up a little bit, but basically the distinction between knowing what one can control and what one can't control, and the prayer ends, give me the serenity to know the difference between the two.
And particularly the wisdom to know that too. Yeah,
that's, exactly.
That's the hardest part really exactly. To come. For the clinical psychology side of this, if we could, Heather, what's the latest research showing? If you have now a magnetic devices like what Dr. Bailey is talking about, but you also have a clinical component to this whole thing. What's the latest research and trends showing there that are becoming more helpful in dealing with this?
Yeah, absolutely. First of all, the field of mental health is very excited that we now do have a new tool, because for decades we had no new treatments. So it's good to see the emergence of other options, and really the interventions for mental health and for people at risk for death by suicide must be customized to the individual. One size does not fit all when it comes to treatment. And too often individuals seeking care don't get the right kind of assessment in terms of what is the right match. So there are a lot of medication treatments, as people know about, that are effective, antidepressants and that kind of thing. But at the same time, as you say, there are more psychological counseling-based interventions that are extremely effective in terms of not only dealing with the underlying mental health issue, like depression or anxiety, but also with providing that support and the coping skills that are necessary for people to be at lower risk for suicide. So a lot of these kind of talk-based therapies actually teach people how to recognize their own risk levels as they fluctuate and to learn more adaptive coping skills or ways to kind of deal with those. And one of the big coping skills, as everybody's been talking about, is support. So being able to reach out to people for the support when you need it. And that's not easy for a lot of people to do. And it sounds strange, but in a way, some people need to be taught how to ask for the help they need when they need it. And that's an important part of therapy. I think that one of the most important things for your listeners to understand has to do with the fact that most people actually don't seek treatment at all. And those who do often don't get the right kind of help, or they get an inadequate amount of help. In other words, they don't kind of stick with it long enough. And so kind of the bottom of the triangle here is just encouraging people to reach out to their counselors, their church pastors, their primary care doctor, whoever it is they feel comfortable with, and engaging on that path of treatment, whatever option would work best for them.
And for those who are survivors, to have a resource, folks like you, Mary, because you talk about the ultimate empathy, and so many folks, oh, I know exactly how you feel. You do.
Yeah, yeah. And the literature says, too, that that's what survivors want. They want to speak with other survivors. Yes, they want to go in and get therapy. They know they need help. But so many times, they just don't have the energy or the wherewithal to do that. So I think, you know, like going to the Big Bend Hospice Support Group, you can, you know, just meet in a very safe setting and talk about your feelings or just listen. For me, that's what really helped me probably more than clergy, more than anything, was sitting in that group and just talking and crying or whatever you need to do. There are really people there who listen and understand.
That ability to bring empathy to the situation, because the isolation, whether you are contemplating suicide or whether you are a survivor, is no one can feel what I'm feeling right now. And when you find out there are other people who feel exactly the same way, that breaks down a lot of internal barriers, doesn't
it? Yeah, it's like I'm normal. Yeah, these guys, you know, look at these folks. They are, some of them are where I am now, and some of them are better. Some of them have been coming here for quite some time. So it's just, you know, sometimes I feel like it's the best kept secret in town, and that's not a good thing. So I'm just letting everybody know that Big Bend Hospice is fabulous and their group is great.
Yeah, together we can get through this.
Yep.
Yeah. And we will get through this break, and we'll be back with more with our terrific panel, Dr. John Bailey, Dr. Heather Flynn, and Mary Bowers here with us as we talk about suicide in this National Suicide Prevention Awareness Month special here on Perspectives. Your input, too, at 414-1234, 800-926-8809, and perspectives@wfsu.org. We shall return. And welcome back to Perspectives here on WFSU-FM. And we're joined by Carol on line two. Thanks so much for calling, Carol. Yes, go ahead, ma'am.
Well, okay, you wanted me to keep talking.
Yes, ma'am.
So, I mean, with this treatment.
Oh, okay, let's start at the beginning here, Carol, because you're talking on the radio right now. I think you were talking to Lydell before. That's okay.
I didn't know I was on the radio.
Yes, ma'am,
okay,
you are.
So
go ahead.
That's one question. And then I would like Dr. Bailey to talk about the treatment is expensive, is my understanding, and to talk about how long a period of time would you allow or prescribe the treatment without, how long can it go on?
Okay, and you were talking first, I think, about dealing with people with long-term depression.
A loved one being held hostage for a very long period of time, over 20 years. And I'm not going to say that term lightly. That's just how it's hostage/codependency. When does a loved one get to take a breath and say goodbye and do the tough love thing?
Oh, wow. Is that a tough question?
Those are a couple of different issues. I wanted to be sure. At first, I thought you were talking about specifically about TMS treatment and how long does that go on. But I'm not sure if that was the intent.
Okay. Well, I think your first question, Carol, didn't it have to do with long-term depression on the part of someone? You said held hostage. What, in a situation where they were enabled by someone else, or what was the circumstance there?
The family members, or the whole family.
Okay. Why don't you give us a quick synopsis?
I think I'm listening on the radio now.
Yeah. You are. You are on the radio right now. Okay, but you have to turn down the radio so we don't get a 7-second delay back in our ears. So turn down the radio, and that will really, really help, okay? And just listen on the telephone. Okay, we'll see if we could reconnect there with Carol. Let's go to Charles here first on line three. Wants to know about the inappropriateness of discussing the upside of suicide? Well, what do you mean there, Charles?
Correct, yeah, the merits of suicide.
when quality of life is extinguished, is it not appropriate at some level? I mean, we're all going to the same place in the end.
All right. Well, that sounds like a fairly common rationale. I've heard that before. And not wanting to be a burden on people, and the world would be better without me, and that's part of that.
Right. Well, the perspective that I come from as a psychiatrist has more to do with it's not that long a show anyway, so why not stick around and see the rest of the show? Because you don't know really what's coming around the corner. And I've certainly seen enough people turn the corner with both conventional therapy and with TMS therapy that I can say that really it's worth it to be working on it, because the people that I see recover from their depressive symptoms and recover from suicidal ideation, some of the best days of their lives are still ahead. I hate to see them lose that, because suicide can very easily be a permanent solution to a temporary problem.
Is there also – we've heard this term too, talk about – slow motion suicide. Most of the attention goes to the dramatic one-off incident, but are there cases in which this takes years through just very unhealthy behaviors, smoking, drinking, all that sort of thing, and it still comes from the same place?
I think you're talking about many cases where people do engage in what we refer to as, you know, self-destructive behaviors, or oftentimes what you see there is an underlying depression that people really kind of have a sense of why bother or hopelessness, which are some of the symptoms of depression. I'm just going to echo with what Dr. Bailey was saying is, many of these cases, and even cases where, to get back to the caller's point, where people are just kind of facing a lifetime of suffering from their perspective, and they see death as an option that would be better than what they're seeing. Even in those cases, there are astounding stories of people coming out on the other side of that and being very regretful that they had felt that way. There are very interesting accounts of people who survive very serious suicide attempts, like jumping off the Golden Gate Bridge, and they report that the second they realize what was happening, they completely regretted it. And so I think the take-home point here for people is that depression takes such a hold on the brain and the body and changes realistic thinking in such a way that can lead people down these slow, destructive paths or to an acutely, you know, crisis-based decision that's just very tragic, not only for that old person, but for everybody around them. This affects everybody. And so we really like to just keep making the point that, you know, getting help for that underlying sense of despair and depression can be the difference and turn people around.
Yeah, and I think, Mary Bowers, you and I had talked about this before, that in Brooke's case, her mindset had its own logic. To Brooke, this all made sense somehow.
And honestly, you know, knowing her history and seeing what she went through, I can understand how she felt that way. You know, it is unfortunate, you know, that she gave up, but I can totally understand the viewer's point there, that we all go to the same place at the end. But Brooke was only 31. She could help other people. She would go to FSU, to the sessions that they had there and to the group sessions. And she was one of their best facilitators. If there were therapists there who had a hard time reaching some of the folks who were there in their DBT program, you know, Brooke totally understood it. She couldn't apply it to herself, but she could step in and help other people. So it is. It's a terrible disease. Mental illness is something that we really We really need to increase our awareness of devastating effects.
Yeah, and we've heard that too, that if you can get outside of yourself, focus on good works in the community or something along that line, then you won't think about this anymore and everything will be fine.
Well, I see you looking over at me, Tom, and I, you know, that in my mind immediately brings up that there's more than one part to it. There's a biological part, a sociological part, and also a psychological part. And when I see somebody who can't really respond at the time to saying, you know, do good works in the community and be involved in esteemful, constructive activity, when I see somebody who's having trouble with that, I start thinking biological, because I've seen enough people do well and then start being able to hear that. Once they come around biologically, then they can start being able to hear the cognitive therapy, and they can start being able to reconnect with people. It's unfortunate not everybody responds to all the things we throw at them, including biological, but a good many do, and it's worth looking into if you're having these kinds of symptoms and troubles.
As you're talking about TMS, there's one metaphor that just keeps reappearing in my
brain. I wasn't just talking about TMS, but I was including the medicines that we can
offer
too.
But
go ahead.
But as far as TMS is concerned, how many of us have been doing some work with our computer and it gets into one of these weird cycles, and no matter what we do, we just cannot get it to do what it's supposed to do? When in doubt, reboot. And it sounds a little bit like when you're putting a high magnetic field on these neurons, you are essentially rebooting them in a sense.
We're actually doing that in a little bit more of a detailed way, because we're rebooting in a specific area that we know is very associated with depression. And we know that from many years of research in people who have had strokes, and knowing where the neuroanatomical location of their stroke is, and how oppositely that correlates with their depression. And we know where those locations are. That's how we decided on this particular area for treating when the protocols were being developed for this type of therapy.
Back to the phones we go here. Let's go to line two here. Lisa has been patiently awaiting there. Hi, Lisa. Welcome to Perspectives.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm actually Elisa LaPault. I'm the executive director of NAMI Florida. So I really appreciate the opportunity to pose a question. And I'm glad that you're focusing on this issue. And I'm glad that Mary's there from NAMI Tallahassee, our local affiliate. My question is, from a policy standpoint, how should our local lawmakers, our state lawmakers, address this issue of suicide, especially when it's becoming more prevalent among teenagers?
Oh, good question, Lisa, and thank you very much for your input on that and for everything that NAMI does. Do we want to go around here, folks? So what should be done? We have a legislative session that's going to be coming up in a relatively short space of time, and it'll be time for those folks to come back to Tallahassee and focus on some of these issues. What would you like to see?
Well, I don't mind starting out because it allows me to give a plug to the American Psychiatric Association's Typical or Troubled program. And this is a program that's sponsored by our national specialty organization, the American Psychiatric Association, that involves teaching counselors and staff in high schools how to recognize when a teen is starting to have a problem that might be more than just the usual teenage angst. And since this is a question about teens, that brings up the idea that we need to be able to recognize when someone's really starting to have a problem. A number of severe mental illnesses do onset in the late teens, schizophrenia probably being the most notorious. And if we can intervene early, the studies show that we can actually prevent impairment. And so I think it's important to recognize things early. And that particular program is available to schools throughout our state and throughout the country.
Okay, Mary Bowers, what would you like to see public policy-wise?
I like clinicians. I think we have a group in town that is working towards providing more support to attempt survivors. those attempt survivors that are at increased risk of suicide themselves. But, you know, to bring trainers to Tallahassee, there's a program in California that's evidence-based, and we would like to bring to Tallahassee and two other communities in the state. But there's no money. It's very expensive. It's, you know, cutting edge. We know we would like to do it, but there's just no funding. So if we could get some money from the legislature so that we could bring the trainers to town and help at least start at the local level, maybe we would have a chance.
Okay. Well, what would you like to see, Heather?
Yeah, I think I could echo what Mary and Dr. Bailey are talking about. There are two evidence-based programs that were mentioned. Unfortunately, Florida is 50th in mental health spending in the nation. And so what I would really like to see are across the continuum of the healthcare system, an infusion of support, financial support and capacity support for evidence-based interventions. We have interventions all over the United States and the world that are known to be effective in terms of awareness, prevention, intervention, and then something Mary's brought to Tallahassee known as postvention, which is after somebody dies by suicide. How do you rally around with support in terms of those who are now at increased risk? Outreach, treatment, these are all things that are known to work. And if we could kind of put them all together and infuse the already struggling community mental health centers with some more staffing and training funds, we really have the potential to move from last to first here in the state of Florida. Your listeners may know that the governor's Children and Youth Cabinet has a suicide task force that's been assembled. And we are really looking at these across-the-board statewide interventions that will put a major dent in not only mental health outcomes, but death by suicide outcomes in Florida.
Of course, where the rubber meets the road initially is getting help to begin with. And I think that's what Jason wants to address here on line one. Let's go to him. Hey, Jason.
Hi, yes. I just wanted to talk about what kind of mental health you're getting, and one of the things I caution people to do is when you go into any type of therapy, you may want to consider firing your therapist if it's not working out for you. Also, when you're in a group setting, you can have people who tend to latch on to you, and it's kind of an armchair therapy session, and that doesn't really help the individual. It can actually turn them off.
Yeah, I see Dr. Bailey shaking his head there. What do you think, Doctor?
Well, I think both points are well taken. There has to be a really good therapeutic fit between therapist and patient, and a good selection of what type of therapy is going to work best, whether it's a supportive therapy or a cognitive therapy, and dialectical behavioral therapy is a therapy we have in Tallahassee that is more and more available. It's very helpful too. And so making a choice is important. But I think if you are going to move therapists, it's important to talk to your therapist about that. Otherwise, you could end up just going to a series of therapists, and that what's happening is you're actually reacting to your own fears rather than what's something that's fitting or not with the therapist. So that can be a tricky thing to do. And the thing that really helps with that is talking to that therapist before you would move on. And then there was a second point that you made. Could you make that again? And I'll try and address that.
Absolutely. When you go into a group setting, whether it be...
I got it now. Okay.
Celebrate recovery.
Exactly. So, yeah, you know, that can be a tough thing. It's best to do the work in the group. And there are a number of different types of groups. Meeting peers in the group, not to say that you can't meet peers in a group, but that's a burdensome you both come carrying burdens to that group. And so when you base a friendship on what's going on, some of that is based on those burdens, and it gets hard to unburden when you're dealing with somebody that basically you met them at the same place that you're trying to unburden yourself. Sometimes it can work, but you got to be aware of those risks. It's definitely true.
Well, time draws short, and if I could just paraphrase what Elizabeth wanted to say here very quickly. We only have a moment left here. A family member who is destructive, depressed, and latches on and won't let go. What should you do?
That's one of the most difficult situations that family members and friends face. There are now decades of research showing the impact of depression on the family. There's some studies that actually go so far to say that if you're living with a person with depression, you're more likely to actually get depression. And so there's no easy answer to how you maintain the relationship with the person but not kind of diminish your own health.
Well, we could talk about this for another hour, folks. I really appreciate it. Great discussion today. Dr. John Bailey, Dr. Heather Flynn, and Mary Bowers, thank you for being on Perspectives.
You're welcome.
And
thank you.
Have yourself a wonderful day. Perspectives produced by WFSU-FM in Tallahassee. Taylor Cox and Lydell Rawls on the point. Hurricane Hermine is gone. The memories and thousands of tons of downed trees and branches linger on. We'll talk about it next week with city leadership right here on Perspectives.
Audio copies of Perspectives are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. Log on to WFSU.org for online archives and podcast. Perspectives is a production of 88.9 WFSU-FM, Tallahassee.